Good day and welcome to Ascend Radio, your home for the latest on regulation, licensure, and digital government. Today, I am pleased to present the second part of my conversation with Kerry Colonisi, in which we discuss some of the most notable findings he's encountered across years of regulatory research, the role of regulation in combating the effects of climate change and achieving climate goals, how regulators and thought leaders can do a better job of highlighting the silent successes of regulation, and much more. Without further ado, let's get to the second part of our conversation. So over your years in regulation at the Penn program, you've done a ton of research, ton of learning on a wide variety of areas of regulation. So I'm curious, what are some of the notable findings learnings you've encountered over your time? Do any jump out? Do any or have any countered, you know, your own previously held beliefs about regulation and, you know, what ought to be regulated and how?
Well, let me just pick up on in answering that question on the last point I was making about obligation management and sometimes regulators needing to lift obligations or alleviate obligations. One study, just to address your question, but with one example, and I'm happy to talk about any others, but one example, it was a study that I published recently with a couple of former fellows at the Penn Program on Regulation. We periodically have postdocs, and this study with Gabe Scheffler and Dan Walters and I, we took on the approach that some have taken of regulatory accounting, where I think you know, folks may be aware of research, say, coming from the Mercatus Center, where their efforts to count the number of obligation-related words, musts, shall, shoulds, and so forth in a regulatory corpus, very much treating regulation as a noun. And we said, well, that's interesting, you know. And as a researcher, I'm someone who's counted things before. I mean, that's often what we do. So I get that. But it seemed to me, only a partial picture of what regulators do, because regulators are and needing to be more active over time. And one of the ways they're active is in alleviating obligations as well. So what about the number of words in the regulatory corpus that relate to obligation alleviation? Words like waive, exempt, accept. These opportunities for obligations to be limited or exceptions to be made to them are part of also the regulatory corpus. And what we found is that when you actually look at various sources of law, whether it's statutory law or agency regulations, that for about every five or six obligation imposing words, there's also an accompanying obligation alleviating word. And sometimes those obligation alleviating words can apply broadly to giving a regulator authority to waive a vast swath of obligation imposing words. And I think I take two things away from that study. One, that I think are important and as you say, you know, a type of learning. One is that the world of regulation is about much more than just burdens and obligations. That's important, but throughout regulations, there are a host of limiting and alleviating features as well. So if we're going to look at and have the common perception that, you know, regulation is just imposing burdens, it's always burdens, well, that's wrong. It's not. I mean, we've documented that it isn't. The second thing it relates to my earlier point about regulation as an activity, as a form of obligation management that's an ongoing enterprise of lifting and tweaking and refining and modifying and learning. That's really the essential, I think, prescriptive lesson to come out of that research, that we need as regulators to shift away from just thinking about solving problems by only imposing obligations. Sometimes problems call for alleviating obligations too.
Exceptions to the rules. Exceptions.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So I need to, you mentioned it earlier, I need to talk about environment, climate for a moment or many here. Climate change is obviously central to or pertinent to most human activities anywhere you look in the world. And yet, with the prevalence of misinformation that we discussed, even the fact of anthropogenic climate change is in dispute or else scorned as woke. And yet all science, you know, agrees. And, you know, as I look out my window here in Toronto today, I see tinted hazy skies, which you might be seeing down in Pennsylvania as well.
I'm told New York has probably the worst air quality today of any city in the United States, or certainly in the world. Even maybe New Delhi has worst air quality, but it's pretty bad here in the Northeast today. And yeah, you're right. I mean, this is a clear effect of the intensity of. It's not that we didn't have forest fires before, but what we know about climate change is that it's increasing the frequency and the severity of these natural events.
So as you contemplate the future of, you know, the planet, of humanity, vis-a-vis environmental regulation, just as the EPA's capacity to mitigate environmental harms seems to diminish, what kind of role do you see regulation taking to combat the effects of climate change, achieve climate goals broadly, and ensure a livable future for all our children?
Well, I mean, it has to play a central role. You know, climate change is a classic market failure. You know, we have negative externalities in the language of market failure occurring because the people who are creating the climate change problem, who are contributing the pollution, are not bearing the full costs of it. Now, to some extent, you might say we're all contributing to the problem too, and we're all suffering, but I don't think we're all contributing equally, nor are we all incurring the costs that are equal too. So I think most there's also an aspect of the ability to change. I think it's difficult to tell a household that's struggling to meet their monthly rent bills that they also need to pay for heat pumps or to convert, you know, gas stoves to electric or so forth. So there's distributional elements that are problematic. Another aspect of climate change that's difficult is it's an international problem. So you all in Ontario there may be able to achieve net zero by 2030, perhaps, but that won't really amount to a whole lot if the rest of the world is continuing on a business as usual trajectory with greenhouse gas emissions. This is what I've sometimes called the collective action problem on steroids. It's not easy. Regulation is critical, but and in fact, in some sense, it's obvious. The way to solve the climate problem is to reduce emissions of greenhouse gases, and or I suppose find technologies that can absorb it or remove it from the atmosphere. But all of those solutions, as conceptually obvious as they are costly. And how do you force people to internalize their externalities? Regulation is a traditional tool, but it doesn't operate in a vacuum. needs to have, regulators need to have authority to impose regulations. And that authority in democratic systems comes from elected officials who are certainly affected by those who are benefiting from the status quo. We don't have future generations voting today, do we? I think ultimately the solutions are social, not technological, and probably not regulatory in the traditional sense of just coming up again with the right rule. It's an activity, but it's going to be a social activity that involves all of us. It requires fundamentally normative change, where we start to view activities that are contributing to climate change in much the same way that are deemed to be morally reprehensible as human slavery is today. And that's not to say we've eliminated human slavery around the world, but I think it is at least certainly viewed appropriately as morally reprehensible. And we need ultimately, I think, to have social mores start to view climate change through that kind of normative lens, it's got to be deeply sustained throughout society. It's going to be difficult because, as you started off today's discussion with, we're living in a fractured, polarized world, and climate change is certainly one of those issues around which many publics are divided.
So another borderless issue that's global in nature is obviously AI. And I think I've read too many articles about AI regulation, and I don't even know what to conclude about it anymore. What's your, I'm sure you've thought about this, I know you've written about it, and machine learning regulation too. I don't want to say simply, what's your take on AI regulation? Because I know it's complicated, but I also know it's a lot less, it's costly than environmental regulation, and it's going to affect us all. But what are your thoughts these days around AI regulation?
Well, one of the big concerns in the world of computer science right now is travels under the banner of misalignment, where these algorithms might operate in ways that are misaligned with their developers and the rest of the public's values and interests. And I think that's a good way of thinking about regulation in general. It's all about misalignment. Regulated food manufacturers or regulated professionals may at times want to cut corners that are more, and save on costs. But the role of the regulator is to try to encourage them and shape their behavior so that it is more aligned with the public interest, right? If anytime regulation is needed, it's because of a misalignment problem. And regulation is clearly needed with respect to artificial intelligence tools. Why? Because we know that these tools in various applications can create problems. There's not a socially optimal level of incentive for the AI developers and users of these tools to address those problems. Those problems fall over on other people. They're kind of externalities too. They're distributed, whereas the costs would be concentrated on those that are developing and using these tools. So regulation is needed. The question is how to do it. Another question is, by the way, who to do it. As you said, it's a global problem too, right? So even if Europe develops new artificial intelligence regulatory standards, doesn't mean that AI firms here in the United States will necessarily, at least immediately, follow what the Europeans require, or that AI in China will do that either. So there's a global dimension to it, but there's also I think the biggest challenge is there isn't one thing called artificial intelligence. It's first of all, the techniques themselves, the data analytic techniques, are highly varied. Machine learning sounds like it's a thing, one, you know, it's a machine, like you could, but it, there's actually different types of learning algorithms, some that are supervised, some that are unsupervised, some that operate in with different kinds of mathematical properties. So that's one thing. But the second thing is that machine learning itself isn't a problem. It's not that, you know, like mathematical algorithms by themselves do no one any harm. You know, otherwise maybe my high school algebra teacher should have been regulated more. But the real problems arise when these machine learning algorithms are applied and used, whether it's in self-driving cars, whether it's in medical technologies, whether it's in social media platforms, whether it's in marketing and political campaigning, all sorts of different contexts in which AI tools will be deployed. And some of them will create serious problems. Some will create problems that aren't in need of public attention. But they're also, when you list out what the dangers or risks are of AI, I mean, it ranges from disinformation and deep fakes to cars that are crashing or power facilities that are shutting down and everything in between. Those are, you know, it's a daunting task. Fortunately, I think we have regulators in place for many of the domains in which AI will be applied, such as medical devices, for example, or automobiles for self-driving cars. And those regulators just need to up their game and develop the capacity to regulate well. We may need some new regulators for uses that are novel, like in social media, for example, or at least to assign them to some existing regulators when appropriate. But yeah, it's a very daunting area. Much like with climate change, some of what's difficult about it also is social. And that is, we haven't really always defined clearly exactly what the problem from these applications are and how to define them in a way that would permit us to impose some regulatory standards that were sensible on AI tools. That's why I think at least in the short term, a management-based approach to AI regulation is very much needed and appropriate. Let's have the AI regulators do what the food safety regulators are doing, which is impose on the regulated entities standards for analyzing their own risks and taking actions to address those risks.
So, like, building off of, you know, food safety there, and, you know, this is my closing question before I look to see if the audience has any, but, you know, the consequences, as we discussed earlier, are just so, so visible, and, you know, they hit our families. So I've long likened regulators to, like, risk management officers, insofar as the scope of their success is generally silent. And, you know, they face the same frustrations over justifying and highlighting their value when most of their successes go unnoticed. For, you know, they succeed when bad things don't happen because of regulation. And you highlighted this in your talk last month, that, you know, they do get noticed when things go wrong in headlines, when buildings collapse, when, you know, a chiropractors sexually assault a patient, and after years of, you know, complaints that went unnoticed. Or when trains derail too, for that matter. Or when clean water is contaminated. So how can regulators, lawmakers, thought leaders around regulation do a better job of sharing and highlighting the otherwise silent successes that live sort of in between the worst case examples of regulation gone wrong?
Well, it's probably, you know, not something that can be totally solved. I think it's something hardwired into humanity. We pay attention more when an oil rig blows up in the Gulf of Mexico, and it's hard to ignore that, right? And disasters are captivating. This is what the media cover and so forth. But I do think, you know, you can look at areas like, for example, aviation safety, where, you know, that there's been just a marked decrease in the number of accidents that are occurring over time. And in part, that feeds into this notion that, you know, the success of a regulator is invisible because we're just not seeing them. But I think you can start tracking them. You may not convince the entire public, but I think regulators certainly need to gather their own performance metrics, again, for learning sake, but also they can be used for communicating what the regulator is doing, maybe to the broader public. I'm a little less sure that you can fundamentally turn around the dynamics because the public's not going to pay attention to everything. They'll pay attention much more to the disasters. But legislators, other overseers can be educated. So thought leaders are who I would target with telling the regulator story about how they're being successful. And sometimes that can take advantage of some of those performance measures that can document changes over time. And then make a visible case. I think, by the way, let me just close by saying regulators need to not only address this issue for the broader public or for the legislator overseers, they need to be able to tell it internally too. It's part of any organization needs to be, you know, some management of their goals and how well they're doing. And it's vitally important, if nothing else, to be able to tell that story about why a regulator is being successful to those who are working in the regulatory agency. It's also important, of course, just, you know, not to say that you should be only Pollyannish in how you're communicating. Those things that are going wrong need to be surfaced as well. And that's a great opportunity for building a learning organization, one that recognizes the successes and tries to build on them, but also recognizes where there are areas in need of improvement and tries to address those as well.
Very good. I see we have one question, and I'll just invite anyone else to submit your questions if you have any as well. But this comes from Susan. Are licensing boards structurally impaired due to their inability to receive information from sites which do not report disciplinary action, for example, healthcare institutions, risk management? Unlike the monitoring of food processing regulation, there is little ability to monitor actual practice performance from healthcare institutions. Anything to say about that?
Well, first thing I would say is that nothing is ever etched in stone, right? So though it may be the case that our current institutional arrangements keep healthcare regulators, licensing authorities from having access to institutional risk monitoring data, but maybe that's an area that we could do better at by sharing that data or requiring that they be shared too, if necessary. I think the thing about professions is that, you know, through to professional education and the whole process of inculcating younger students into a profession, building esprit de corps in the profession, that process of professionalization itself is a way of shaping behavior. It's a type of regulation, maybe not rules-based, but enculturation. Because of that, you know, the quality of care has improved across a range of professions over time. And maybe the big bad examples of the chiropractors who are engaging in sexual assault, as you mentioned, Paul, are perhaps, hopefully, relatively rare occurrences. If that's the case, maybe a way of thinking about what licensure organizations should do could be taken from the aviation sector, where, again, fortunately, we have very few major commercial aircraft accidents happening. That's a good thing, but it also makes it hard to regulate because you don't have a lot of feedback built into the system. So what have we done was in the United States and in other countries, we've developed what I would call a signaling strategy by developing a system for data collection on reporting of near misses and other kinds of safety concerns. And those that system allows people to report something that could have been a safety problem, even if it didn't manifest in a crash, it's a proxy for something that's problematic. And that data then can be analyzed for trends and used to support better risk management and better regulatory approaches. So I would urge us not to be totally limited and think about whether there are ways of partnering perhaps with or on a voluntary basis, convincing some large institutions to start sharing that data, because it's in everybody's interest. It certainly would be in the interest of most large healthcare institutions, I would think or hope, or they could be persuaded to think this way, that that sharing that with a licensing body could be very meaningful and valuable. Maybe you have to find a way of anonymizing the data, de-identifying it, or maybe making assurances that these data are not going to be used in a punitive way, but rather to evaluate and to learn. But those kind of protections could be built in, much like they are with the aviation early reporting and near miss system.
That's great. And finally, just before we close here, forgetting for a moment the most important or the biggest issues, what's focal for you right now? Like, what is either keeping you up at night or occupying most of your time over at the Penn program?
Well, I mean, I think what we spend a fair amount of our time on, and I guess I'll end on a very hopeful note, really, is the next generation. Ultimately, regulation, again, is not a noun. It's not a thing. It's not a book. It's not words on paper. It's people. It's people. And I think the best ways to solve the problems of today and certainly the problems of tomorrow is to make sure we have the people who have the skills and the orientation and the values needed to pursue regulatory excellence throughout their careers. So I spend a lot of time with my students as well as with the research and outreach that we also do. And work studying the big issues, climate change, inequality, pandemics, artificial intelligence. These are all pressing issues, but I think the core to succeeding in regulating these new domains and these persistent challenges is to make sure that we have the right people in place. So, I always I'm working with our younger students, but we're also running a regular executive education program through the Penn Program on Regulation, bringing regulators together to learn from each other and to diffuse best practices throughout the world. So education training is a vital part of what we do in addition to research and outreach.
And your students give you hope.
They do. Yeah, absolutely. I think we're not leaving them with any, easy successes to be had. I mean, the problems that they're going to face will be difficult ones. They're bright, they're capable, they're earnest, capturing their energy, channeling it, and it certainly gives me a tremendous amount of hope.
Well, Kerry, I can't thank you enough. It's been an illuminating and pleasant hour. So thank you for your time. Thank you for your thoughts and your wisdom. It's always a pleasure to speak with you. And thanks everyone else for attending.
Great to be here. Thank you very much, Paul.
Thanks for listening. If you missed it, don't forget to check out part one of our conversation with Kerry Colonnese. In the meantime, head on over to Ascend Magazine to sign up for our Week in Brief. And don't forget to subscribe to Ascend Radio, where every Monday we publish our Ascend Radio Week in Brief with the top stories in regulation, licensing, and digital government. Till next time, stay informed and stay safe.